I'm Cindy. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm in a weird space, so you're going to get what you get. And I'm not sure what that's going to be tonight. So I'll start with my sobriety date. If I can remember it. August 22nd, 1992. I have a home group. It's Keep It Simple. In Fishersville, Virginia, we meet at the Community Care Center at 10 o'clock on Sundays. So if you happen to be in our area, you are welcome. It's an open meeting in it. We have a speaker last Sunday of the month. I have a sponsor. She's with me today, so I cannot lie. And she has her fourth and fifth step. So, and she is sponsored, and I sponsor women. So I try to be involved and stay involved in the program. I believe that if you stay in the center, you got a better chance. And I've watched people hang on the fringes, and when they do, it's too easy just to kind of trickle out. So if you're new to the program, I'm not going to give any advice because this is my story, but that's what I've tried to do in my sobriety. All right. I'll tell a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I will say this. I didn't understand people would get up and they would tell that, and I thought they were intelligent people and they had really great sponsors. And I didn't realize until one day I was sitting in a meeting and they were reading how it works, and it tells us that in how it works. And I'd heard that thing a million times, and I didn't realize that they actually got it from what we had been reading. I just wasn't hearing it. So the other thing I also realized, and I just realized this year, I am at a place in my sobriety where my first sponsor was. And I used to think that she was this wise, intelligent woman because of the time that she had in the program. And I've actually got a year past what she had. And what I realize is it doesn't matter how long you've got in the program. You still go through stuff. You still backslide sometimes. You don't do everything perfectly. There is still plenty to learn in this program if you're willing to stay open-minded. And I have to, sometimes I have to be, you know, shaken a little bit for that to happen. But that has been my experience. So I want to thank Sam for asking me to speak. Again, I'm here. All right. So I started drinking when I was 13 years old. And it's interesting because I don't know. I have heard a lot of people share that their first drink was Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill, and a lot of people started drinking at 13. So I am not unique. I don't know whether I'm unique in this experience, but my guess is I'm not. But that night that I drank that bottle, now I don't drink a drink, never did even from the first day. I drank the whole bottle of Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. And I was kissed by a 22-year-old, French kissed by a 22-year-old, and I had arrived. It was one of those moments where I knew I was prettier then, I was older then, I was everything that I wanted to be in that moment. And the only difference was I was drinking that night, and it was great. And the next morning, I was with two girls, and they were, I always share this, because they were bad girls. They would have been considered, quote-unquote, bad girls. And I always wanted to be a bad girl, and I'm just not. That's just not in my repertoire. I'm a pretty, you know, normal kid. I was a kid, you know, normal kid, pretty, you know, anyway, I wasn't a bad girl. But I liked hanging with them, because then I thought they'd rub off a little bit. Well, the next morning, we go walking, and we go to the cemetery, and they're sick. They're physically sick from the drinking the night before. And they didn't finish their bottles either. And I thought, this is something I can do that they can't, you know. Little did I know that that was really not something that I wanted to be known for. But so I continued to drink whenever I could. From that point on, whenever I had an opportunity, and as a 13-year-old, 14-year-old going through, you don't have much opportunity. But at 18, at that time, you could drink. So when I turned 18, I could go to the bars. I could get beer. I could drink, and I always got drunk. I have never been one of those people that, my story is not, you know, I started drinking, and then later, you know, it took over whatever mine was. I started drinking, and boy, I'm off to the races because I love to drink. And I don't drink a drink. I drink a drunk every single time. And if I can't drink a drunk, you're probably not going to see me drink. There are times when I had opportunities to drink, and I chose not to because it was one of those, who does this? We're going to give you tickets, two tickets for two beers. You know, what good does that do? That does absolutely no good whatsoever. So I would actually not drink if I thought that that was going to be the situation I was going to find myself in, because somehow I knew, although I didn't understand it until I got here, that I had that, not only the obsession of the mind, but I had the allergy of the body very early on, so that once I started drinking, I just wanted more. And I didn't know that I couldn't control that until later. And then when I tried to quit and found out that I couldn't. So I continued to drink, went to college, almost didn't graduate, and I can tell you drinking probably had a little bit to do with that. Had to call my parents right before I graduated and to tell them that they might want to hold off, might want to wait because I'm failing two classes, I'm not sure I'm going to pass and graduate. So tech gives you an opportunity if you're failing a class and you're a senior to retake. And I think one guy, God bless him, I think he just took one look at me and said, let's just get her out of here. You know, this is not her major. Who really cares? Well, the other class was my major, and he wasn't quite so nice. Somehow I made it through and got out and started working. And I was an educator, and it's really hard to get up in the morning and teach kids when you've been drinking until 2 or 3 or so o'clock at night and go home and then get up and go to work the next day. And I had kids that, particularly towards the end of my drinking, that I would get to school and they would look at me and they'd go, my God, you look like you have a hangover. And I would be like, how would they know? Don't I look okay? You know, I took a shower. I brushed my teeth. You know, my hair's clean. But they could tell. I mean, they knew. And I worked in, at the very end of my drinking, I worked in an alternative program. And I actually got sober while I was working in this alternative program. And so we would always do a novel for some person, and the novel that I was given was Tortilla Flat. If you've never read it, it's who wrote Grapes of Wrath? Steinbeck. All right. So when they were, I had just gotten sober, and so when they divided the groups up, they gave me all the drunks and all the druggies, and we read Tortilla Flat, which is about a group of gentlemen who are Mexicans, happen to be Mexicans, and they're all drunks. You know, and we had a great time reading that book because we could all relate. We all had, you know, we all had uncles and, you know, but, you know, somebody in the family that was that way. So we had a great time reading that book together. And that also tells me, because when I can relate with people who are alcoholics, you know, if we're not on the same page, we can't relate to each other. But we all come into meetings and I can see people go, yeah, and we all start shaking our heads because we get it. So I guess I need to go back because I think I was sober at that point. What got me, my life just continually got worse and worse, trying to drink and trying to go to work and trying to be a, you know, a normal human being. And I was hanging with some people. Actually, I was at the very end, I was first in a relationship with a hermit. And I swear to God, the guy was a hermit. And I would tell people I was in this great relationship. Oh, yes, and we talk all the time. We never talked about anything. We drank, you know, and got drunk. And then through him, I met this I guess maybe he wasn't a hermit because I did meet somebody through him. But it was somebody that he knew from, you know, younger. I met this guy. And so I started dating. And talk about craziness. The night I had met him, and then I had a fight with this guy that I was dating, and I'm drunk, and I decide, okay, and he said, you need to be with so-and-so, and you bet I do, and I leave, and I go to so-and-so's house, because I know where he lives. Now, I've never been to his house before, never been invited to his house, don't really know him, except for this one night when I met him. And so I show up at his house, and his father answers the door. Now, I'm a little muddled because, number one, I'm trash, and number two, what's his dad doing here? You know, well, it turns out it's his dad's house because, you know, when you're with drunks and you hang with drunks, they don't usually, you know, they lots of times don't have jobs, they don't own homes, they don't have cars that function very well. So And his dad's like real excited to see a woman at the door. He doesn't care that I'm drunk because his son has a girlfriend, he thinks. And so I wasn't about to say, oops, got the wrong place, think I'm going to turn around. I was just too drunk to even think about that. But I'm thinking, oh, I don't even know if this guy is going to know who I am. So he's, what's your name, dear? And I said, my name's Cindy. So he's yelling up, this girl is here, Cindy's here. And I'm thinking, and he's going to yell down and go, who? And he doesn't. He actually comes down and remembers me. So the first thing he does is grabs keys and said, let's go, because he wants to drink too. Because I don't hang with people that don't drink. I'm a magnet. You know, if I'm drinking, I'm gonna find a drunk. And so we hit off to go drink some more, like I needed any more that night. So I got with this crazy man, you know, because I'm a crazy woman. So me and this crazy man get into a wonderful relationship, because that's what I think they all are, you know, and because I'm seeing them through drunk glasses, you know, and it's okay that he can't keep a job, and then, anyway, but so we have a very tumultuous relationship. It's not a nice relationship at all. It's the worst relationship I've ever been in with another individual, and it ended, although it didn't really end, it ended the night I was drunk, okay. So, surprise, surprise. And we were going out, we were in Manio, North Carolina. And he had gotten a fishing job down in Manio. And with a guy who was sober. He was actually in the program. And we were drinking with a bunch of his old fishing buddies because he had been a fisherman way back when. And I'm drunk, and when I'm drunk, I'm very flirtatious, and I'm, you know, whatever. I'm the belle of the ball. And so I am talking about, I'm going to move down to Manio, North Carolina, and I'm going to get a teaching job down there, and I'm going to be one of the best teachers they have ever seen. Because I'm sure in Manio, North Carolina, they probably don't have good teachers. Well, these men's wives were sitting across from me, and the disgust in their faces, because they weren't drunk, they were not one of us, and the disgust in their faces were incredibly evident. And but I'm a good alcoholic, so in my mind, I twist that around and think that they're just snotty and snooty, and how dare they look at me that way? Because I've got to justify who I am at that point, because I am not a good person, and I am a mess. And so that night, the guy that I'm with, he gets angry because he flirting, whatever. Anyway, he leaves, and when I finally make it home, or where I'm staying in Manio, we have a physical fight. And and at that point, I was pretty sure that I was done, that he was going to kill me. It was bizarre. I think your body shuts down when things like that happen, so there's a lot of it I don't remember, because when you're getting physically hurt, your body kind of takes care of some of that for you. But what I do remember is coming out of this fight and hearing a voice on the outside and saying, stop, you can't treat a woman that way. And everything stopped, and I got up and I ran out of the house and into the arms of a man about this tall. And he was a boat captain and in the area. And I mean, he took me over to his house and he gave me coffee and he let me use his phone, and he tried to take care of me. Now I'm a mess, so I get on the phone trying to call my sister, and I'm using every sailor's word I can find because I'm a good sailor, and my sister's not home, and I'm cussing at her for not being home, and I leave her this horrible message and get off the phone and decide I've got to come back. I lived in Nelson County at the time. I've got to go back home. Because I always was that way. You know, some people, like, they take trips and they go off all this place. I never understood that because I'm a homebody. So when I'm drunk at the end of the evening, I want to get home, and I will get home any way I can, the place that I feel safest. So I wanted to go home. I'm in Manio, North Carolina. I'm drunk as all get out. I've just been in a physical altercation, and I want to drive home. And I want the cops to stop me because I'm not thinking very clearly. I want them to stop me because I want them to I want to be able to tell them about the guy back there because I want them to go back and get him. Well, thank God no cops stopped me because I'd have ended up in jail. I mean, they'd have cuffed me and take me to jail because I don't know what I would have blown, but it would have been pretty high. So I made it home. Eddie and I ended up getting back together again, crazy, for a period of time. But I'm somewhat grateful for that because as crazy as all that sounds, it takes whatever craziness it takes for us to get in the program. And he actually took me to my first AA meeting down in Virginia Beach. Because, you know, guys, no, actually, I guess it's down in Manhattan. It was down in Nag's Head, I guess, because I really did not want to go anywhere close to home to my first meeting because somebody might know I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't want that to happen. So, you know, I think all my friends were just kind of, you know, sitting on the wings going, Jet, what is she doing? You know, how crazy is her life right now? So I went to my first meeting, and in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, my vision of an alcoholic is a male. He lives under a bridge. He wears a long trench coat. It's dirty. He's dirty. He drinks Mad Dog 2020. That's my vision when I walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am eternally grateful. In the first meeting that I was in, there was a guy who had lived under a bridge for a period of time. But he didn't wear a trench coat. And I don't know if he drank Mad Dog 2020. I just know he's an alcoholic because he's there and said he was. But he was clean and he was sober and he was articulate. But he shared a story. And I'm would be consider myself a high bottom drunk if you were going to label people high bottom, low bottom, whatever. I've since kind of come to understand it's really not about that so much as it's about how we relate to each other, you know, the language of the heart. That's really much more important. But I knew if he could get sober, then I could too. Because if he had come from where he came from and he was sober, he gave me hope. And so I remember that individual, and I remember another woman. I couldn't bring the face, but I could tell you she has blonde hair, and it was shoulder length, and she was probably my height, maybe about my size. And she came up after the meeting, and she gave me a hug, and she said, "Keep coming back." And I thought, whoa, that's really strange. So I went back home, and I was seeing a counselor. If you've ever seen a counselor, we lie. We don't tell the truth, because one of the questions she had asked me was, "Do you drink?" "Oh, no." "Do you think you might have a problem?" "No, no, I'm just, you know, just occasionally I might have a beer or two." And I went to the next session, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, "I think I know what the problem is." And she said, "What?" I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And she when I picked her up off the floor and set her back in the chair, and she said, well, and then I told her the truth. I told her how much I drank. I told her how often I drank. I told her that I didn't know how to stop drinking. And she handed me a where and when and said, "There are meetings in Nelson County." So I went to my first meeting in Nelson County. I was petrified. I went alone. I was petrified because I didn't know who I was going to find there. And just like any place else you go, they took me in. And there's several people. Now, see, this will make me cry. Who were at that meeting. And one of the gentlemen that was there was the person that brought me closest to God. And his name was Elgin. And some people may not know him, but he was an old codger. You know, he had his faults, but he was always in his seat, and you could always depend on him being there. There were a couple people that were like that were always in their seats, and that's one of the things that's incredibly important, is that if you've got to be in your seat. I firmly believe that for your home group, you need to be there, because that's where people see that same person sitting in that seat all the time. And that was such a comforting thing. He was always there. There were a couple other people. One who became my sponsor was always there most of the time. Now, that's another, I'll get there. But you know, when we started talking and they started talking about a God of your understanding or a higher power, I wanted to believe that. That was a bit of a relief for me, I have to tell you. I wasn't sure that my life was unmanageable, and I didn't understand the sanity part in the second step. that those were the two areas I had some angst with coming in. But he would give me the most bizarre books on this earth to read about spirituality and about whatever. And I thought, man, I can do anything. And this guy was older and he was, you know, he's kind of out there. And I thought, that's great, because that means I can, he gave me the open door to believe what I wanted to believe, what I needed to believe in a God. Mm-hmm. And I'm really grateful for that. And there was another woman there, and she said she had this little altar in her home, and it had, I've forgotten what, I remember there was a little Buddha on her altar. I remember that was one of the things that was there, and some other things. And she's kind of crazy, but again, she was another person that just kind of let me know that, you know, they were coming from different directions, but it was okay. It didn't matter what direction you came from. And so that was my beginning. And I had some old ideas. I had some old beliefs that I came with. But when I started drinking, that's when I separated from God. And I recognized that a little bit later after staying in the prayer and listening to people, that once I started drinking, God and I could not be in the same room together, because God would not accept that behavior. And I knew that God wouldn't accept that behavior. But then I got into AA, and you said I had to have a power greater than myself. I didn't have to, but, you know, strongly suggested that, you know, you find a power greater than yourself. And then all of a sudden it was like, okay, well, if you tell me you did these things and you get to have a higher power, I get to have one too, and it's okay. So I began searching, I began reading, I began listening, and I began praying. I never did that before. And somebody gave me a 24-hour day book. They said, read this book every day and say the Serenity Prayer. And I did that. I don't know why. That's one of the bizarre things, because I hear other people, and when I work with women, sometimes that's a hard thing for them to do, and they just have a really hard time getting into that routine. I don't know why it wasn't a hard time. Maybe I'm OCD. I don't know. But I didn't have it once I started. I've maintained that. That is one thing I have maintained over the years. Now, I've changed. What I read has changed. I still use the Serenity Prayer. I think it's wonderful. And then I've added prayers, because people have given me prayers as I've been in here that have worked for me. And one of them is, and I don't know where I got this from, because I'm sure I didn't. I'd like to say I made it up, but I'm sure I didn't. And it was, God, I need an attitude adjustment. I think I need one. I think that's why I'm here today, because I needed an attitude adjustment. And because I just thought about that. I haven't prayed that prayer. I just prayed it. So there you go. So, and those things started to work for me. I would notice that there would be changes. And so there was just something about you guys and being in rooms with you all and listening to you all talk and share. I'm reading a book right now called The Spirituality of Imperfection, and one of the things it talks about is how it talks a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous, but it talks about sharing and listening, and that's where we get it from, by one person sharing and somebody else listening. The stories that we tell are what are so important, because we've got to be able to hear ourselves and other people, and even hear the imperfection in other people, so that we can share our own imperfections. And it's just a beautiful thing. And that is one of the things. It's one of the few places that I've ever been where people actually, even if I don't agree with you, I listen to you. Even if I'm tired and I don't want to be there, I'm there to share and I'm there to listen. You don't see it other places where people actually listen to other people, or at least pretend they do. I mean, I'm sure there are days when I'm tired. I know there are days when I'm tired and I don't hear what somebody says and somebody, you know, but that, I mean, that's just life. But, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while. I'm just going to skip to this year because look at the time. Okay. I'm going to skip back to about 4 years ago, because one of the things that I have had to discover is that some of the worst things that have happened to me since sobriety. So I get into Alcoholics Anonymous. My life goes on well. I think I'm going to get sober, and then everything's going to be okay. That's an old idea for me, that life is just going to be smooth. all it is about is not drinking. Well, it's not about that. If you read the Bedevilments, it tells us we have problems with other people. We have problems in the world. And then we go through the steps, and that helps us get, it helps us deal with those things. Going to meetings, listening to other people and how they've walked through situations, it helps us. It's the whole deal. Sponsoring other people and listening to, when I'm in angst, listening to somebody else's angst gets me out of myself, and when I really need to, and then all of a sudden things turn around. I don't know how that stuff works. It's so backwards from what I think or how I think it should work, but it does. So I have been through the steps, I guess. But, so about four, maybe it's been longer than that, shoot, now. It's been a while. My life was going along smoothly, and then I decided, and with my sponsor, we went through inventory, we talked about it, I decided it was time to get out of the job that I was in and to move on. So that decision was made. I went to my husband, I asked him how he felt about that. He said he was fine. As a matter of fact, one of the things I remember saying is, I've eaten beans before, I can eat them again. I said, good. So I turned in my resignation in January. And I had gone to the VAC in Waynesboro, and I had listened to a couple talk about the traditions. And then they also talked about a retreat that they would do. And I wanted to do that with my husband. So I said, can we do this retreat? And he said, yeah, sure, that's fine. So I got it ready. I'm a teacher, so, you know, I have those, I have it on a spreadsheet. I've got everything set, you know, what. And I kept going to him, and I said, because you're supposed to do it away from your home. I said, do you want to do this? And he's like, well, yeah. And I could never get him to commit to a place. So I said, finally, I said, oh, are you just worried about spending the money? And he said, yeah, that's it. I said, okay. Well, why don't we just do it at home? We'll turn the phones off, just let people know we can't. And he said, yeah, that's fine. I said, okay. So we get there, and I said, where do you want to start? And he said, I don't want to be married anymore. And I went, oh. And I was, you know, I cried, anger. And I'm kind of glad I got angry, because I needed some other emotion to come up at that point in time. And I said, you need to get out. I could. Well, the other question I asked him was, and this is what really, I think this is where the anger came from, so I'm glad I had that, tell you the truth, is that I said, did you know when I quit my job that you didn't want to be married anymore? And he said, yes. And I said, was it about the money and you were worried that we weren't going to have the money? And he said, yes. And I felt this tall. And I said, okay. You need to get out. You need to go. You need to go away. I cannot even look at you right now. And so he did. And you know, you would like to say, well, I couldn't get my sponsor at first, so I called a friend of mine that's in Al-Anon, actually, and I want to talk to you because I'm going to be a two-time loser and you're one, too. Okay, I'm not always the nicest person, not always the, you know, and she just laughed, and she got me, and I talked to another person. They got me to laugh. Al-Anons are good at making you laugh. So, because they've been through, you know, with us, they've been through a lot. So I talked to two Al-Anon women who got me to just laugh about it a little bit, and then I got caught up with my sponsor, and we were talking, and she said, you know, you're going to have to do some inventory. Wait a minute. Okay, hold the phone. You want me to do inventory? Now, I didn't say this to her because, you know, when it's your sponsor, sometimes you keep your mouth shut. And I didn't. I didn't say anything to her. But what is going through my mind is, why am I doing inventory when he's the jerk that's leaving me? Why should I do inventory? That makes, again, that is so against what. But she had told me things before to do that were so against that I trusted her enough to know that I was probably going to need to do that. So I did do the inventory, and we had a month apart because his sponsor said, you're not going to yank or chain. So we had a month apart and then tried to come back, and it just wasn't going to work. And so we eventually had to make a decision. But in the process of that, I had done inventory, and I had to look at myself and my own behavior in the relationship. And then I had to make amends. Jeez, you know, okay, it again, so counterintuitive. Why am I the one making amends? You know, I'm not leaving this relationship. This is all his stuff. But what she had me do, which was, and actually, I have helped somebody just recently because they needed to make amends, and I had them do what was told to me. And boy, I'll tell you what, when you can share that stuff and you pass it on, and it was a guy, actually, and he got it. It was like he didn't at first, and then when he got it, he got it. But she had me write down what was good about the marriage, what he had done that was right. Because when you have to do that, then you have to look at it so that you don't look at it all as this is. I mean, because if you walk away from, I think we've been married 10 plus years. And so when you walk away from that, if you think everything is bad, well, then that's 10 plus years you have lost. But she had me look at the good, and there was good in it. And so which I think surprised him, because when I said I need to make amends, I think he was as shocked as I was that my sponsor had told me I had to make amends. And he wasn't ready to hear it at first. And he said, well, maybe later. I said, okay, because that's what the deal. It's when you were making amends to another person, it's on their time, not on ours. I thought it should be on my time, frankly, in this particular case. You know, there should be exceptions, but obviously there aren't. And so eventually one day he said, okay, I'm ready. We're in a car. I'm like, okay, I can't do this. I need my book, because I'd written it down. And this was an amends I knew I needed. I could not do it on the fly. I needed to make sure that everything was there. I said, can we wait till we get home, because I need my book where I've written all that stuff down. Because I had gone over it with my sponsor. You know, I have been taught, and I believe this, that I write the amends out, I run it by my sponsor before to make sure that I don't have any buts and, well, when you did and all that other stuff, because that's easy to get in there. So it had been run by her, and I needed to stay with the script, because otherwise I might not have. So I got there, and anyway, we sat down, and I made the amends to him. I believe by doing what I've been told to do and asked to do in this program, that opened the door for the rest of my life. Because in the meantime, because it sounds like, don't you feel sorry for me right now? Yeah, I want you to. I want you to feel so sorry for me. But what happened in the process of that happening, and we were trying to get back and forth that summer, I'm kind of trying it, but it really obviously was not working. I had quit my job, so I was done. My mother is a hoarder and needed her house cleaned out because my sisters were going, she needs to, God, you can't get in her house. So I said, okay, I'm the only one that can do that. I'm good at stuff like that. So I said, I'll do it. And I'm probably the only one that would not have committed homicide with my mother doing it. So in the process of cleaning my mother's house out, and I'm applying for jobs in Charlottesville because I want a job at UVA or someplace like that. So I'm helping my mom clean the house out, and I would like to tell you that my behavior was stellar, and it was not. There were days when I'd go to a meeting, and I would say, okay, I'm working in the green room now. And my mother is lying again, and I have just yelled at her like I'm 12 years old, and I'm just, you know, I mean, it was crazy. You know, I took 50-some loads to the dump. I took 20-some loads to Goodwill. I took two loads to her church for Lord's Acre. I mean, it was just, and one day, I just thought I was just going to lose it. So I left to go to the dump. The guys just waved me in because they had seen me enough. And on the way back, I decided to go to my dad's grave. I had not been to my father's grave since he had died about 11 years prior. And I had not gone there. So I decided to go, and I couldn't find it. I was actually right on target to where it was, but somehow I missed it. So I went back to the front, and the guy told me where it was. So I went back, and I found my dad's grave. And I sat by his grave, and I've heard people, this has happened to people. I always wanted it to happen to me, but I didn't know that it would happen to me on that day. And I said, I don't know what to do. I'm about ready to kill her. And I just, I really wouldn't have killed my mother, okay, because this is on tape. but I said, you know, I don't know what to do. And I heard my dad's voice. And he said, Finnegan, my nickname's Finnegan. He said, Finnegan, he said, just finish it. Just go back and do the job. Just finish the work. You know, we have always argued as a family. We have always yelled at each other. That's part of the deal. Just finish it. And, you know, I knew he was right. My family had yelled at each other forever. That's not a big deal in our family, you know. And so I took a deep sigh, and I went back to the house, and I apologized to my mother for my bad behavior. And you know what my mom said to me? She said, oh, that's okay. She said, I'm just glad you're here doing it. Okay. All right, I guess my dad was right, you know. And so I did, and I finished that job. I have pictures to show if you ever want to see them. It's great. So I'm really proud of what I did. So anyway, so in the process, I'm going to AA meetings there. And then at the end of August, we make the decision that we're done. We're not going to. So, and then he calls me up. I'm at my mom's house, and he calls me up, and he says, why don't I just buy the house from you? Great. I don't have a job. I don't have a home now. Thank you very much. And I'm going to be leaving the only AA I know. So thank you very much. I'm going to lose everything. Everything that I know to be good. And then I sat in the orange room. And you'd have to go to my mother's house. Anyway, I was in the orange room, and I was sitting in a chair. And I started thinking about that house. Can I cuss on this thing? No. All right. It's not a nice house. It needed a ton of work. He had put tons of holes in it, okay, that had not been repaired. And I just decided, and I called my sponsor up, and I said, you know, and she said, you know, I'm kind of thinking the same thing. Just let it go. I said, okay. Then I had to worry about it. I don't have a place to live. And frankly, guys, I did not want to live with my mother. So that day, my mother offered me to live with her. Thank you very much. My sister offered, and she has a lot of space in her house and a place upstairs, offered me a place. And my best friend from first grade offered me a place to stay in her home. I had three offers of a place to live on that day. And so I was taken care of. Now, that's a gift. And I chose my sister. I asked my sister if I could stay with her. That was a good time for us. We had some angst in there, but that's okay. So I know people in AA. I know my sister. And I have a place to live. Now I just need to find a job. Okay. Now, this is how I find a job. We were just talking about this coming up. And this, it's all kind of, you know, so, somebody said you can knock on doors. If God wants you to open it, it'll open. If it's not meant to open, it's just not going to open, but it doesn't mean you don't knock on the doors. So I was applying for jobs, and one of the jobs I applied for was with the Virginia Employment Commission at Piedmont Community College. And I can't remember what the job was, but it doesn't really matter. Because I'm at my sister's, and I'm typing up an application or something. And I get this email from this strange person. And he said, you know, I looked at your resume, and have you ever thought about applying for jobs with the Community Service Board or with the Department of Rehabilitative Services? Well, number one, I don't know what either one of those are. And number two, I don't know who this lady is. So I emailed her back, and I said, well, thank you very much for giving me this information. I said, but I'm just really curious. Who are you, and how would you have even seen my resume? Well, she had been on the committee to pick the person for the job at Piedmont Community College, and she just, from what my background was, thought this would be a good direction for me to go in. Okay, now, it even gets weirder, because I am starting I'll get to that in a second. Anyway, I talked to somebody in AA, and I said, you know, I'm going to apply for this job. DRS has a job. I'm going to apply for that. I'm going to apply for Community Service Board. There's a job there, too. And he said, well, you know, this guy in AA works there. I said, really? He said, do you want me to tell him that you're applying for the job? I said, well, yeah, because I have no idea what this job is. And so he told him. He said, have her come over, and I'll talk to her about the job. Well, he talked to me about what the job was. He showed me things so that when I went in, and I got an interview, when I went in for the interview, I knew what the job was I was applying for. Otherwise, I could have looked on the website and I still wouldn't have understood. So when I ended up getting a job. Now, how... that, I mean, there's just too much stuff there that you just can't say, you know, that that's not. So I have a lot, as bad as that situation started out looking like, I had lots of instances where God was in my life and that where it's just too much. There's just too many things that happened. Well, I also, at the same time was going on, I started dating a guy. And we're still dating today. I don't do things real well. Relationships are kind of, anyway, so I just am. And that's been an interesting ride also for me. So, where do I want to go? I want to talk about sponsorship a little bit. I think, because being sponsored and sponsoring, because when I moved over to Stanton, I had a sponsor who was closer to where I lived at the time. And there's some things that happened, and I ended up having to look for another sponsor. Now, again, I had already been talking to this woman, the woman that's my sponsor today, and she had helped me through that situation. Again, I have to look at myself and everything, and what I recognized was, at that point in time, I needed a sponsor closer to home. I needed somebody that could see me, because I mean, when you're going through that many changes, I needed somebody that kind of had the thermometer, like, right at me to make sure that if I was, like, really squirrely or really crazy, that she'd see that. And we belong to the same home group, so, you know, she would see me fairly regularly. And so, you know, that I wanted, it was a good move for me. It was a really good move for me. It didn't feel like a good move, and it happened, and it was kind of hinky the way it happened, and it was messy. It was kind of messy, and I wish I could have done it better, but you know, I've screwed up in AA a lot. So when I sponsor women, I've had to make amends to women that I've sponsored before, and I've had to call my sponsor when somebody's not done something right, and she. I called her one day. Okay, and this is actually really good. This was a good lesson for me. I had a sponsee. And I don't know what happened, but you know how when you're having a conversation with somebody and the conversation goes south, like, and you're like, oh, I can't stop it. It's just going, and it didn't stop. She got mad. I got mad. She left. She was at my house, and she left, and she got angry, and I called Rosemary up, and she says, well, you know, you probably do owe her an amends. Well, she knows me well enough to know the first thing I'm going to do is defend myself and justify my actions and say I can't do it and blah, blah, blah. And she sticks with me through that. And finally what got me was she said, you know, and I was wrong and I knew it. You know when you're wrong, God, if you stick around long enough, you know it. It's sometimes it's hard that you know it. But she said, you know, we have to make amends to people. If you've never had an amends made to you, sometimes you don't realize why you have to make them. You don't realize. She said, by her being on the other end of an amends, that might help her make amends because she might understand what that feels like. Well, okay, she had me. I was like, darn. You know, I'm a sponsor, so I am, you know, there's some things that go along with that. And so I made the amends. Now, here's what it has done for me. We are still, if I see her, we hug each other. We like seeing each other. We don't have to go to the other side of the road. That's what amends does. It allows me to stay. Now, that may not happen all the time. But in AA, where it's close, you know, it allows us to be okay, to be imperfect, and to show people that we can right our wrongs, you know, and how it works. And so I'm grateful for that. I sponsor some unique women. I've heard some unique things. This year I have heard some things that have been difficult, and difficult to work through and difficult to figure out how to handle them, you know. And but we were talking about that coming up. That's part of the deal. And you learn, I think, a bit of forgiveness and a bit of we're not perfect. None of us are. And that we do the best we can. And we're ready for changes when we're ready for those changes. And I think that's one of the lessons just recently I've had to learn, because I had to make two amends, one yesterday and to someone in AA, and one 2 weeks ago to someone that I work with. Now, when that kind of stuff happens, it's not them. It's me. And so you can... I don't care how much time you have. You can go through funky times. You can go through periods where you're just kind of off the beam. It talks about being on the beam and off the beam. And you're getting me off the beam. But the good thing is, and this is the hope, is that you get back on. You eventually get back on. As long as you keep doing the deal. You know, I stay in touch with my sponsor. I don't isolate and not go to me, because that's what I want to do. That's honest to goodness what I want to do right now. I don't want to go to meetings. I don't want to see you guys. I don't want to talk. I don't want to do any of that stuff. But I'm here, and I got to round up with my sponsor, and we get very little time just together sometimes. It's hard to do that because we both work and we're both busy. And it was exactly what I needed. So God gives me what I need when I need it. And it's all through the program. I mean, there's lots of, if you're sitting here and you're going, geez, just stick around. You know, I heard a guy that used to say, oh, I forgot what he used to say. Hang on to your seat. It's the ride of your life. You know, another guy that would say, I come to remind myself that I'm an alcoholic and I can't take that first drink. The gentleman that I talked about when I first got sober that was always at meetings, he passed away. God, now I don't even know. I'm terrible with time frame. And I was asked to speak at his funeral. Now, I got to tell you, people would not ask that of me, you know. And I get to do honorable things in situations that I would never have been asked in the past to do. And I don't know. They're just things that happen in this program. You just can't imagine, and you just don't know. And even being here speaking today, if I said anything that could help, that's great. I'm here for a reason, and I don't know what that's for. And that's when I prayed when I went back to the bathroom. I just don't know what that is. Sometimes that's hard for me, because I want God to send me an email and tell me exactly what He wants me to do and exactly who He wants me to be I'm sorry, guys, that has never happened, and I just guess it never is. So, but I'm going to keep coming back, and I'm really glad to see some of you guys that I haven't seen in a while. And, oh, this is good enough. Okay, all right, and I think that's it.